Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Grand Rapids, earned a BA in Business Administration from Parsons College, and served in the U.S. Army from 67 to 1970. From 1981 to 2001, he was a principal of FX Coughlin Company, a global provider of integrated logistics services. Since 2004, he's been the owner and president of Pass Charters, which provides air transportation services to a myriad of entities. A member of the board of Faraday's Troops First, his name, Bill Larkin. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to a most extraordinary person, Bill Larkin. What an intro. Welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. Glad to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood, your mom and your dad, and your six brothers and two sisters?
Yes. Well, start with, my father was an illegal immigrant from Ireland. Originally came over to Canada and during the Depression walked into the United States and jumped on a train and rode the rails to Chicago, and where he met my mother, and got himself into the paint business because he could speak English, and most of the people in the plants there were from Eastern Europe, so that got him into management. He moved to Grand Rapids where he raised his nine children. My mother was originally from Wisconsin, and he was offered to go back to Chicago, but he didn't seem like he could move nine children from Grand Rapids. So he walked across the street and went to work for his competition, and actually retired there. Both my parents lived most of their life in Grand Rapids and are now deceased.
What's the biggest thing, Bill, you learned from Mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
Well, I think from my mom was how to get along, because with nine children, she never really had any favorites. And she was kind of in the middle of solving all the problems. And so I think I learned from her the ability to get along with people. And I think from my father was discipline. And I think a pretty strong religious background. He raised us in the Catholic faith, and well ingrained.
The people that know you think you don't always tell the truth 100%. You say the biggest thing you learned from Mom was how to get along, and from Dad, discipline. So let's go to your junior year of high school. Getting along and discipline, you get thrown out of the Catholic school. What happened?
Well, today I probably wouldn't have been thrown out because it wasn't publicized anywhere that you couldn't drink on school property. But we had a very tyrant principal, and I was always already on an indefinite penalty writing the rosary every night after school. And so I think I finally hit the top banana in it was unfortunate, but it led to a lot of great things and kind of sprung me forward to a different way of life.
All right. Then the summer between your junior and senior year, a different way of life, you're thrown into the clinker for drinking, or fighting, rather.
Fighting after drinking. the judge told me that he was going to teach me not to fight in the middle of Grand Rapids, and he actually did. It was... my father, in those days, it was a $90 fine. And in 1961, that was a lot of money. And so he grounded me for the summer. I had nothing to do but kind of get in shape. I was not going to plan on playing football at Central High School, but I ended up playing football and making all-conference and ended up with a scholarship to Parsons College.
You had a 1.9 in high school. You wanted to go to college. How did you ever get to college?
Well, a lot of people won't remember Parsons College, but they were really kind of way ahead of themselves. It was actually a college that made money, but their ideas were to teach team teaching, tri-semesters. They utilized the whole physical plan of the college throughout the year. They paid their professors top five in the country. And they accepted a lot of students that other schools wouldn't, or they accepted a lot of students that didn't quite make it their freshman year. So I was sent the scholarship letter, told I had to report in 2 weeks to take remedial courses. And I was fortunate enough to, when I tested high enough that I could take regular college courses. And so going to summer school, I got a jump on the rest of the students. And that was the start of it.
From 67 to 70, you served in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. What did you do?
You know, I just congratulated a friend of mine who said he had joined the Army 50 years ago. And I said, well, I joined the Army 50 years ago, but 13 days ahead of you, so I got date of rank. Friday the 13th, 1967, I joined the Army and had signed up for Officer's Candidate School and ended up seeing part of the U.S., Fort Dix, New Jersey, Fort Ord, California, on to Fort Eustis for OCS. And 6 months later, I graduated. I happened to get married my last month in Officer's Candidate School because I was pretty sure by then I was going to make it. And right away I got orders for Germany. So I was one of the few people never served a day in the United States. 2 years on to Germany and got actually assigned to the 519th Car Company in Heidelberg, which is Army headquarters. So I had the ability, or not the ability, but the fortunate of spending 2 years there, ending up as a company commander. And it was a great learning period because I dealt with everybody from the commanding general of Europe down to enlisted drivers. So the ability to use that military training and the ability to work with people really started there. And very fortunate. Most of the people in Germany then, it was the Cold War. The buzzer would go off, the bells would ring, and the infantry and the armor would go out in the field for a month at a time. Army headquarters, we'd go off for an hour, and then we'd go back to regular work. So it was a great assignment.
We're talking to Bill Larkin. If you look up in Webster's Dictionary for the word salesman, you see a picture of Bill Larkin. And when we come back, we're going to ask him his first sales job. And I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Bill Larkin. 1971, you get a job with Noxema selling skin cream.
Yes, I returned to Grand Rapids after my active duty in the service, and having been overseas for 3 years, there was really no place else to go but back home. And I started looking for a job and ended up selling, getting a sales job with Noxel Corporation, makers of Noxema and CoverGirl makeup, and which made my sisters and my mother happy because I could give them free samples. And so I started, and Western Michigan was my sales territory. And it was a decision that was prompted by I needed a car, so I got into sales because they provided salesmen with a car.
Unbelievable. 1972, Northwest Airlines hires you to sell air cargo in New York City.
Yes. I, with a transportation background from the Army, having run a car company in Germany and then a motor pool in Thailand and Southeast Asia, I looked and said, all right, air freight is really going to be the way to go in transportation. Something new, wide-body aircraft are coming on board. So I got a job with Northwest, and they were just coming off a very long strike. And I started out in New York City, covering the garbage district along with Newark Airport. And those days, actually, cargo was regulated. The airlines were regulated. And so I started deregulating cargo sales in New York by stealing a lot of customers from Eastern and American and everybody else. So it was a great opportunity. Spent 2 years there before my promotion to Detroit.
Promotion to Detroit in the late 70s. You helped bring the third-party concept of shipping parts via air to the big three. How did you convince them?
Well, you know, timing is everything. And when I got to Detroit, the auto industry was good, kind of a down cycle. As they were looking for ways to save money. Many of their clerical people were unionized. And if you walked into Ford or GM at the time, they had hundreds of people chasing parts, calling suppliers, finding out where the trucks were, finding out if the guy shipped, he didn't ship, did he ship the right quantities. And it was an opportunity where we really sold them on us taking over those jobs. And at the same time, with deregulation in the air industry, we could cover all bases. We could cover the whole country, where GM might have a shipment in Minnesota, they had to deal with Northwest Airlines. If they had a shipment in Georgia, they had to deal with Delta. And we convinced them they could deal with us, and we'd handle all that accessorial business. And that led the Ford Motor Company choosing us as their sole provider for domestic air freight. And GM of Canada did the same thing. So we grew rapidly at the FX Coughlin Company because of that business.
You've always had a can-do attitude. Your attitude is, let's win the business, and then we'll figure out how to fulfill the business. Most people say that translates in disaster, but that's worked very good for you. How do you do it?
Well, I think you have to understand the customer and understand their needs and think the same way they think. And in the automotive industry and time-critical deliveries, you didn't have to be afraid to spend the money. You had to keep the assembly lines going. You had to understand that they needed this more than you thought they needed it, and you could never make a mistake. Therefore, we would go the extra yard. Case in point, General Motors was looking for airplanes to go to the West Coast. They'd have a train derailment, and all of a sudden they needed every plane in the world to get their supplies out to their West Coast plants. I actually started flying planes out of Windsor, Canada, Canadian aircraft, to the West Coast. And it had never been done before. And it was new business for Air Canada. It was good business for General Motors, kept their plants going.
The only constant in life is change. And for 20 years, 81 to 2001, you were a key partner with the Coughlin Company. What were the biggest changes in that business in those 20 years, Bill?
Well, I think the largest was getting into the total logistics. Case in point, with Ford, General Motors, even so much as when Ford bought Jaguar, people were looking at, hey, if I give you this business, you need to take all of it. So not only did we manage all the ocean freight shipments for Ford Motor Company, and we'd report from the time the shipment left, when it got on board the ship, when the ship left, all that key critical information so they could plan their pipeline. But if there was ever a hiccup, like a snowstorm in Indiana, we knew in 2 weeks later we'd be flying parts. So it was being able to take all of their business and not segment it, where you had one guy doing the trucking, one guy doing the packaging, one person handling ocean shipments. If it came critical, they had another company doing air freight. We did it all. And That was a key part of our strategic growth.
In 2004, you create a new company called Pass Charters. Tell us about Pass Charters.
Well, Pass Charters really developed. I had met Greg Campy, who's the coach of Oakland University. And Greg said, hey, I'd like to be able to see if I could, you know, fly my team. Well, at the time, I was involved with a couple 19-passenger airplanes that we were actually bought one from a race car driver, Petty. And we were flying race car teams, the mechanics and that, to the races. And I said, well, Greg, I got this 19-passenger airplane. We could fly your team in that. Well, you talk about jumping into something. I didn't realize all these kids weighed about 240 pounds apiece. So they had 19 seats, but we could only put about 15 of them in the airplane because of the weight. But that's really where we started. We handled Greg's trips. He was in this conference where they're playing in South Dakota. They're playing in Western Illinois, places most people never heard of. And so that was kind of our start. And then after that, we just started branching out into larger airplanes. We'd bring airplanes in, and you know, last year we managed over 50 schools. Not all of their business. We might do the women for this college. We might do everything for another college, hockey for another college. And so we're trying to bring a logistics bent to college transportation. Because in the past, it's been all over the map. And you could go to Willow Run, and Michigan might have four different airplanes on the ground, two for the incoming teams, two for their teams going out. And we're just trying to bring some sort of logistic sense to all this. And like we did formerly with the automotive industry, is try to manage it better so that somebody who's inexperienced and gets stuck with a job doesn't make the wrong decisions.
You softly, humbly mentioned that you do this for 50 schools. There are 50 of the premier schools in America, the Dukes, the Notre Dames, et cetera.
Notre Dames, Wisconsin's. I think one year we had three of the final four teams in the NCAA finals. So this year we're branching out, now starting to do baseball in the colleges. We've done a little bit of football. Primarily, the basketball teams are the biggest users of charters because with the new TV schedules, if you looked at the Big Ten, they're playing Fridays, they're playing Mondays, they're playing Tuesdays. The TV contracts have generated the need to have live content every night. And so, I mean, 5 years ago, they used to play on Thursdays and Saturdays. Now it's almost every day. So to get the student-athletes back on campus, they really have to do more and more charter.
We're talking to Bill Larkin, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Bill Larkin, who since 2004 has been the owner and president of Pass Charters. If you want to learn about them, www.passcharters.com. Bill, you've been around a lot of these college coaches, icons. What have those college coaches taught you?
Well, I think as you look at them and you find out, you know, once you get out of the TV, and they're not really larger than life. They're really great guys who are dedicated to their sport, to their colleges, and you find out that they're working a lot of hours. We do a lot of the recruiting trips now for coaches, and they work so hard, we have to supply two crews on an airplane. They start at 7:30 in the morning. They want to go from this state to that state to that state. And now with the new pilot regulations, they can only fly like 12 hours. So, you know, we end up starting the day with this crew and working in another crew halfway to keep up with them. And so, I mean, they're out there pounding the pavement. And
one thing that's amazed me as I've met with some of them, let's take Campy, for instance. You ask him about his 87 squad. And you ask him about the 11th kid on that squad, and it's like it was yesterday. They come to love. These kids are their nephews.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an idea. I'm with my good friend Hoot McInerney, and we're going out to a golf tournament in L.A. called Friends of Golf. And we just happened to stop at South Bend and pick up Digger Phelps. So Digger's coming out to the tournament with us. And, you know, it's like 4 hours from South Bend. And Digger and I are sitting there talking about basketball. And Digger had a habit of every time he emphasizes you, he punches you in the air. Well, now he's telling me about how he broke UCLA's winning streak and all this stuff. I said, Digger, I don't remember where my golf score from last week, let alone what your team did in 1978 or whatever it was. But they know and they remember. They could tell you, you know, what was a critical shot that they won or they lost on. And they're amazing people.
You say you don't remember your golf score from a week ago. Some of your friends say the biggest thing is you don't remember the bet you lost 2 hours ago. Just kidding. Talk about the life of a D1 collegiate athlete today.
Well, that's unbelievable. It is the first of all, is you know, it's no longer a season. I mean, they're there for the year. I mean, they're practicing. They got fall camp, winter camp, spring camp. There are regulations that prohibit the coaches from being with them sometimes, but, you know, I mean, the basketball D1 players, they're gym rats. They're there. They're practicing. And then you throw on to the travel. You know, we fly teams in this American Athletic Conference. I mean, they're like mid-major teams, but they don't have the same budget as a Duke or a Michigan State, and they're going out, and they got 3 days between games. They're not going back from Texas to South Carolina or North Carolina, wherever they might have originated. So they got the holiday schedules now, the Thanksgiving tournaments. Everybody's going to the Bahamas. They're going to Disney World. But those kids, I mean, that's right in the middle of classes. So you got to take your hat off to them to maintain the grade level that they do. And you look at Oakland U, and the kids keep getting better grades and better grades. So, I mean, that's a lot of self-discipline on their part with all their commitments that they have.
Anybody who knows Julius Giammarco, his most famous expression is, oh, he's a client. Every name you throw out to Julius, oh, he's a client. Every name you throw out to Larkin, oh, he's a friend. Tell us about Arnie the King.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, my good friend at Oakland Hills worked a year and a half to get Arnold to come to Oakland Hills for our scholarship trust. And again, Hoot McInerney helped on this. But we get Arnie to come in. We cut a nice deal with him. Half of the money we raised went to his charity, which is, he supported that hospital down that he named for his wife in Orlando. I mean, he supported millions and millions of dollars. But Arnie comes in. He has his Arnold Palmer drink. He's handing out that to people. You're talking about a salesman. He's still selling. He was still selling at that time. But Arnie came in and did a great job. And, I mean, it really got to him. People don't know he had such a background in Detroit. He opened up. 1946, he had played in an amateur tournament in Detroit. I think it was at Detroit Golf Club. And he reminisced about that. Nobody had ever heard that he was in this tournament and what it meant to him. But he said he ended up the same people in that tournament competing with him for the next 50 years. Okay, and, of course, he won the U.S. Amateur Country Club of Detroit. He helped raise a lot of money for Cornerstone Schools coming in. But 2 months after Arnie was here for the Oakland Caddy Scholarship, five or six of us went down to Orlando to present him with his check. And he was so gracious to spend an hour and a half with us. And what a great guy. And he was leaving the next day for Africa. That was going to be his last time as a crewman on his jet. I think he was 81 at the time, you know. But what a tremendous guy.
Jack Nicklaus.
Jack Nicklaus is another one that I had met a couple times through Cornerstone Schools, ready to help, try to help Clark Duran over there raise some money. And Jack was so gracious to be there. He also came to Oakland Hills, where he had won a tournament. And he came to our Caddy Scholarship Trust. And just a great guy. I mean, just one guy that's so attached to his family, so involved with his grandchildren now. And that's one thing you just take away from these people, that they have time, you know, for their families. And also to give back. I mean, we've raised a lot of money for our scholarship trust in Oakland Hills, and it's to gentlemen like these.
Late last year, you had Gary Player come for that scholarship night.
Gary Player doing push-ups up on the stage. You know, I mean, what a great athlete and what a great champion at Oakland Hills when he won the PGA there. And if you looked at all the travel that that man did from South Africa at that time and age, I mean, he won a lot of jet planes back in those days when he started. So the tremendous record that he had in winning majors is unbelievable.
You mentioned twice now Hoot, the famous Hoot.
Hoot McInerney, what a guy. I mean, there's... it's funny, over the weekend, a friend of mine just bought a house in Bloomfield Hills, and so he was showing me, and I looked on the website and checked out Hoot's house, which is still for sale. And all the rooms that I saw in this website, I'd never been in any of those rooms. But I'd been to Hoot's house 50 times. That's how big his house was. But what a gracious man, and what a charitable man. Just great. I mean, he to take care of people from all walks of life. Hoot and I spent 3 days on an aircraft carrier in the Atlantic. And Hoot, at the time, he always kind of had a little heart problem. And there's no elevators on an aircraft carrier. And it's 13 stories. So you're walking up these different, like, planks and stairs and really, really tough, especially for Hoot at the time. And he was giving out $100 bills to sailors as we're walking down these hallways. And finally, the command sergeant major, or, well, that's an Army term, the Navy equivalent was a lady. She came up to Hoot. She said, "Hoot, you got to stop doing that. You're like the Pied Piper here. You're going to have the whole crew following you around." But the second night we get done and Hoot's kind of pooped out and kind of ready to hit the hay, and guy knocks on the door and it's the Admiral's aide. "We'd like you two gentlemen to join the Admiral on his deck for a cigar." I said, "Hoot, when are we ever going to be sitting up here smoking cigars in the Atlantic Ocean on an aircraft carrier?" So we trudged up there and Hoot made it. But one of the most charitable persons you'd ever meet in your life. And just, it didn't matter who you were. You could be working behind the counter in a restaurant. He walked back there and gave him $100. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Somewhere in the Bible it says, you know, when you give, don't let the left hand know what the right hand's doing. And that was Hoot McInerney.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking to Bill Larkin, and I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Pasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Bill Larkin. As I mentioned at the start, a most extraordinary man. Bill, you got thrown out of high school your junior year. Then you got thrown in prison. You had a 1.9 in high school. You're one of 9 kids. You're the most unlikely to succeed. How have you done so much?
Well,
it's your pretty face, is what it is.
Besides that, it's, well, I think the biggest turning point in my life is when I realized I could not handle alcohol, and I quit drinking about 38 years ago. And that realization that I didn't know whether I was going to have one drink or five drinks or whatever. Made me make a commitment to not have the first drink and put my energy into working, into raising my family, working with friends, playing golf, whatever. But that was a big, huge turning point.
Speaking of friends and not drinking, you're extremely close to David Ferretti, who by his own admission, a typical day for him was 30 to 40 Vicodin and 2.5 bottles of whiskey, real whiskey. Tell us about David Ferretti.
David Ferretti, I first met, he was our first speaker at Oakland Hills Scholarship Trust Night. And I had met David on a couple occasions before at golf outings, and so I knew enough just to say hello to him. But we really sat down and spent about an hour together that night. And he started talking to me about his charity, Troops First. And David at the time was not a U.S. citizen, okay? But the passion that he had in the support of our military, especially our wounded warriors, was unbelievable. And I told him at the time, I said, David, I'll give you a flight a year to move these wounded warriors wherever you want them. And so he put a deal together where they would take wounded warriors to the NCAA Final Four. They got the Coaches Association to support these wounded warriors, or Gold Star Children. Okay, we've flown them. David probably spends 10 to 20 outings a year, whether it's bicycling, it's hunting, it's golf. Just a remarkable man, you know. And he is one of the funniest persons that you'd ever meet. I mean, so quick wit. If you ever watch his TV shows, you can tell that. But it's his organization is really run by a guy named Rick Kell, another dedicated person to helping the wounded warriors. And Troops First, it's a small charity, raises $3 or $4 million a year, and it's but that $3 or $4 million, you know, 95% is going for this. To the wounded warriors.
If you want to learn more, www.troopsfirstfoundation.org. You've met a lot of phenomenal warriors. One, a Medal of Honor winner, Leroy Petrie.
Well, Sergeant Petrie, a true American hero. I first met Leroy. He came to Oakland Hills with Rick Kell, again at a scholarship trust dinner. We wanted to introduce Troops First and the concept to the Oakland Hills audience. And Leroy had never really played golf before. And if you Google Leroy and you look up what his exploits were to be awarded the Medal of Honor, you'll find out that he lost his arm and his hand doing it. When he got the apparatus, or the arm, they gave him an adapter for a golf club. So his first round of golf was at Oakland Hills South. And it was unbelievable. Now he's really getting to be quite efficient. But Leroy is one of these guys now that he retired from the service. And he's working full-time for Troops First. He also has a lot of commitments, being a Medal of Honor winner. But he's giving back and... I know, I think Leroy's now on his 7th or 8th return trip to Afghanistan. They'll take wounded warriors back to where they were disabled, where they were shot up, and let them leave on their own terms now. And this has really helped the mental capacity of these wounded soldiers of ours to understand what they had to go through, and now they can maybe take control of their life a little better. But Leroy's really a true American hero.
Speaking of really helping these heroes, another part of Troops First is where you provide service dogs.
Correct. This again, through the generosity of some friends at Oakland Hills, I think now were over 10 dogs from Oakland Hills members. To buy a dog and get him trained is $15,000. But, and they're trained in Wisconsin, beautiful animals, and unbelievable what they do as far as giving the wounded warrior the security of knowing that they have this dog. Brandon Macaro lost all four limbs in Iraq. He's one of seven people in the world that had two arms reattached. To think of the capacity he has now with this service dog is unbelievable. Or to be around a guy who's suffering from PTSD and see what the dog has changed his life. I mean, it's unbelievable. And again, we're Troops First is a small charity, but you know that that money is really going to help our wounded warriors.
www.troopsfirstfoundation.org. What's the single biggest thing you've learned from these wounded warrior heroes?
Well, it comes that you, by being around these guys, you understand that though it's an all-volunteer army, they were out there for us. They cashed a check when they got hurt, they got wounded. But you realize through them that there's people out there every night. Every night there's people taking care of us around the world. And volunteers are not. They're out there. We're not. And that's really where I realize that you pray every day for them. And I try to tell people and make sure they realize, even though hopefully we're not losing very many people now, but they're still out there and they're prepared to do what they have to do.
Bill Larkin, speaking of praying, when you pass, St. Peter, our Lord's going to say the six greatest words a man can ever hear. Well done, good and faithful servant. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Small. Believe.